This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted today to be here with Ellen Levy. Ellen, maybe you could introduce yourself briefly.
Yes, I'm a New Yorker, bred and born, and I am teaching now at the New School, Consciousness and Creativity, and am a special advisor for IDSVA, the Institute for Doctoral Studies in Visual Arts. I'm an artist.
So what we thought we might talk about today is the convergence of interest between artist performance and neuroscientists, which seems to be growing in interest and excitement in the last few years. Why now?
Yes, I do see examples of this everywhere, and I think that there's a number of reasons why we're seeing an increase in this. First of all, people pretty much accept the idea now of neuroplasticity, the ability of the neurons in the brain to be modulated with experience, and the growth of a belief in epigenesis. But I think beyond that and new techniques, there's examples where the arts can actually provide something of value to the sciences beyond the kinds of things that used to be done in psychological testing.
Let me just pick up on the neuroplasticity point. We're both over 50. and so it's reassuring to know, actually, isn't it, that the brain continues to develop.
Absolutely.
And that it doesn't all happen before the age of 25.
Absolutely. And for anyone who's seen family or friends with strokes or bad deficits, it's also quite reassuring that there's much more growth possible than ever was thought.
One of the points that I made to you before of why now, you know, why this convergence between the neurosciences and the arts is particularly interesting is that in the last 10, 20 years, neuroscientists have developed these new technologies for looking at how the brain is working, MRIs, fMRIs, and so we've gone sort of, it's like a new age of discovery. My analogy was when astronomers developed the first telescopes. Anything you looked at was new.
Well, that's true, but they both tell us more, but there are also shortcomings in these, as we know, too. But I think as a kind of paradigm for what is happening, if you think about the problems that exist in reading the Herculaneum scrolls that cannot be unrolled without being damaged, and you think of the way you need to peel the neurons to understand them, to understand the connectome, you see that both are really need a technology involving tomography in order to solve both problems, which seems to me the essence of interdisciplinary thinking, where the problem, the thing that's important is that each field is experiencing a need to understand the same kind of problem.
Right. In space science, the kind of technology you're talking about is we call remote sensing. So how do you view at a distance to try and understand something? Now, obviously, astronomers can't experiment on the universe. We're observational scientists. And in a very real sense, neuroscientists are in the same situation where if you actually take the brain apart, well, then it stops functioning. And so you're really in a remote sensing situation.
Well, again, there's some very exciting collaborations going on. I think, for example, in Switzerland, the laboratory of Olaf Blanc is involved with understanding autoscopic or out-of-body experiences, and he is doing this via examining artists using virtual reality to see how the body feels when it's displaced.
One of the arguments you've developed, and I'm just going to pick up on that point, is you know, one of the reasons of this current interest is actually the convergence of a number of different angles of attack on the problem. One of the ones which I think I'm going to disagree with you about is the third culture idea. So why don't you tell us about why you think that's important?
Well, I do think that there's a lot of activities now going on that had not happened before. One example is one I was a participant over the summer in a workshop on art and consciousness at Watermill, which is run by Robert Wilson, the playwright, and he runs this in conjunction with Marina Abramovich. And there's a whole network of neuroscientists involved with this. Last summer, there were several neuroscientists who were examining primal attachments, children, their parents, and Daniel Stern was intimately connected with the group, who's a very well-known child psychologist, so that this is an area of study was opened up also by a psychologist named Suzanne Dicker, who took a look at the work that Marina Abramovich was doing and decided to actually measure with a collaborator to measure the degree that people, by staring at each other across a table, for example, really did have their brains merge, and to try to quantify this process.
Just to come back to the third culture point, so it just reminded me that my father started the Leonardo Journal in 1966, actually, is when the first paperwork was started, almost exactly 50 years ago. And one of the things he did as part of that, and we have the napkin in his archives, he tried to write down the name of all the scientists he knew that had active careers in the arts in some way. And he ended up with a list of 9 people that he knew on the whole planet that were in this nexus between the arts and sciences. And he decided, he wanted to start a society for artist scientists, and he decided there weren't enough of them. What is true today, as you and I travel around, there's just a thriving activity in so many different places in this nexus.
That is absolutely true. I think of Daniel Levitin, yeah, who is both a neuroscientist who wrote a book about music. He was a visitor, yeah, to Watermill. There's a program called Brainwave at the Rubin Museum of Art, yeah, which brings together these kinds of conversations. And as I said to you earlier, there's always been interest from artists in the neurosciences, but really what has changed is the belief that that artistic endeavors have value for the neuroscientists. Part of it probably has to do with ideas of embodiment and metaphor.
Very good. So you actually have 6 of these factors. What would be a second one that you think is driving this nexus at the moment?
One thing I thought was the fact that scientists realize that their own field of study is not enough to get answers to questions involving consciousness and emotion.
Right. And I guess, you know, part of that is the specific subject matter. I mean, to the extent that you're trying to understand human behavior and human perception, there are clear connections with the arts that exploit, manipulate human perception. But also, as Robert Root Bernstein has documented, as you know, there is sort of beginning to be some serious research that talks about the creative process of scientists and how they get new ideas to help understand the things they're studying. And so this toggling between the art point of view and the science point of view can be something that redirects the scientist's attention.
Well, the other thing, too, even mentioning Robert Root Bernstein, his initial book, that was published about 30, 35 years ago dealt with the scientists and their creative endeavors, just as you were stating. But actually, the number were very high, perhaps not professionally, but for sure the interests were there in the creative fields. Many were musicians. Many found music absolutely essential to their capacity to do good work.
And you know, it's a complicated question of whether correlation is causation. One of the PhD students in the Art Science Lab here is Catherine Evans. She teaches music. There are something like 800 science and engineering students taking music classes. A colleague of hers, Kathy Lingo, is teaching improvisation techniques to scientists. And so indeed, clearly among scientists, there is a deep interest in these kinds of activities feeding into their professional life.
And I think there are other reasons also. Emotion used to be avoided like the plague by scientists. The idea was that qualia really could not be measured. And there are ways now to get around this. People like Damasio, Joseph Ledoux, Jacques Poncek, and others have really investigated this. And so it has been amenable to quantification. This was something that did not happen 10 years ago, even to the same extent.
And I would totally agree with you. And one of the things we chatted about is Eric Kandel's book, The Age of Insight, where he talks about 1880s Vienna and this nexus at that time. And that was not between neuroscience, it was between psychology and the arts, where indeed there was a shared interest, which I think is around things like human emotion and things which are very real. But often in scientific inquiry outside of the terrain. And so, you know, I think part of what we're seeing today is because we now have the cognitive sciences and the neurosciences that have just developed so much in the last 20 years, there's that renewed connection with the arts.
And I think in the case of Eric Kandel, it's even more remarkable that here you have someone who has had the tenacity to do all the research, and he's done a considerable amount for the book, and as I understand, he's involved soon with another to look into this relationship. But he also, in many ways, represents a particular approach of science that of reductivism and the value of it, which nobody will question. For him, it was a study of snails and aplysia and the fact that you could have an animal with relatively few neural connections in the brain. But I think that the arts has gone in a somewhat different direction right now in terms of opening up to complex systems, to interaction, to a different set of connections between the spectator and the artist to an extent really not imagined before this. Some of it technologically based, but a lot not actually.
Okay, so we're going to have to wrap this up.
Where the mind is the medium.
Well, we're going to do a second podcast, so I urge the listeners to look out for the second podcast. But I'm just going to leave this. I think this is the first time I've heard an artist talk about the power of reductionism. Thank you, Ellen. Look forward to our next podcast.
Thank you.